Okay, this is some speculative work that I've been doing, making an attempt to find some connections between number theory and supersymmetric black holes. So many of you, I'm sure, have noticed that in trying to learn about string theory and supersymmetric gauge theory, some of your mathematics is best obtained by looking at books on number theory. So modular forms, congruent subgroups, and elliptic curves are of interest both to the string theorist and to the number theorist. So is there a deeper connection? Such a connection could have very interesting ramifications, might be very fruitful if there were some interesting relations. When you start to look at the detailed questions that people ask, you find immediately that the kinds of things that get number theorists excited are orthogonal to the kinds of things that get string theorists excited. Let me illustrate that with one example. The elliptic curve with modular parameter tau, that's my notation, is very interesting and very common in string theory, but we never have any compelling reason to restrict attention to elliptic curves over Q or over any other number field. And the point of this talk is that there is a compelling physical reason to restrict attention to certain certain elliptic curves because of the attractor mechanism of Ferrara-Kalish and Strominger. And in the cases where I can solve the attractor equations exactly, it turns out that they are arithmetic varieties. The hope is that the arithmetic of these varieties has some bearing on the BPS spectrum and things like that, but that remains largely a hope. Let me begin with a quick review of the attractor equations. So X is a Calabi-Yau threefold. M tilde is the Tiefler space or modulized complex structures. A charge vector is an integral three-form cohomology class on X. And if you have a complex structure, then you see you have a Hodge decomposition. And the attractor equation is an equation on the complex structure, which says that the Hodge decomposition is of this type. So this equation occurs when localizing the minima of BPS masses, Ferrara-Gibbons-Kalish, and constructing n equals 2 black holes, Ferrara-Kalish-Strominger. Many of you will probably recognize the alternative formulation, which is this. That's equivalent to this. So let me briefly remind you about that. The minimization principle goes as follows. If you compactify 2B on Calabi-Yau threefold, generically the abelian gauge fields are valued in the three-form cohomology. So the dionic charges, the electric and magnetic charges, are integral three-form cohomology elements. Now, in the superselection sector gamma, or equivalently the homology class gamma, in H lower 3, the central charge of the supersymmetry algebra is given by the period over the volume. This is a well-defined function on Teich-Muller space. And if gamma supports the BPS state, then it's the mass squared of the BPS state. So there's a nice theorem, which is that if this has a stationary point and it's non-zero, then the complex structure satisfies the attractor equations and is a local minimum. The other connection to physics occurs when you try and construct static, spherically symmetric, dionic black holes. You make an ansatz for the supergravity fields. Here's a standard ansatz. You solve the Killing-Spinner equations, and you're led to some dynamical system describing the evolution in the radial coordinate of the moduli. This is complicated, of course. The thing you should notice here is that on the right-hand side is the 2,1 projection of the charge. So the equations for the fixed point of the flow are the attractor equations. And under good conditions, indeed, you have an attractive flow to the fixed point. As Andy was saying, the picture is that you have, outside of the black hole, you have some radial flow here. You start out with any old complex structure here, and it flows to a fixed point in Teichler space that looks like that. Well, there are several examples where you can solve the attractor equations exactly. For brevity, I'll concentrate on one example, K3 times T2. Some nice simplifications occur. For example, you explicitly can express the charge in terms of the electric charge and the magnetic charge, which are elements in the two-form cohomology of K3. That's because H3 is related to the H2 of K3, two copies of the H2 of K3. The solution of the attractor equations is the following, up to some subtleties I'm suppressing. The solution is essentially a product of three elliptic curves. The K3 surface is a product of two curves over Z2. It's as simple as it could possibly be. There are two modular parameters, tau and tau prime, which are given in terms of the charges in this formula. And the irrationality is given by d sub pq, a very familiar expression. Tau and tau prime, as I just said, are quadratic imaginary numbers. That means they're in this field extension. That means they're rational plus rational times I squared of d. These K3 surfaces that arise are very special. They're called exceptional K3 surfaces. They have maximal rank of the neuron Severi lattice, and they form a dense, isolated set of points in moduli space. For us, it's important that they're classified by binary quadratic forms. The binary quadratic form in this case is this very natural quadratic form that you can make out of the charges. And here's the discriminant from the determinant. Now, this solution of the attractor equations leads to three kinds of relations to arithmetic. First, if you look at u-duality inequivalent charges that nevertheless lead to the same near-horizon metric, then enumerating those charges turns out to be a class number problem. Second, in the case where we can solve for the BPS spectrum at the attractor points, the masses of the BPS states turn out to be norms of ideals in a field. And third, and to my mind the most significant connection to arithmetic, is that the attractor varieties are actually arithmetic varieties. And that's because of something called the theory of complex multiplication. I'll now explain. Here is a lightning course on class numbers. Let's consider a binary quadratic form, just that 2x2 matrix. A, B, and C are integers. And we ask, what are the SL2Z equivalence classes of these forms? Clearly, the determinant is unchanged. It's nicer to talk about the discriminant, b squared minus 4ac. Well, the result is that there's a finite number of inequivalent forms. If these integers are relatively prime, then this number, h of d, is called the class number. And it's known to be bigger than 1, with the exception of 13 values of d. As a result of these people, I think you'll agree they're reliable. So the way we should think about these classes is in terms of points in the upper half plane. That's the nicest way to think of it. So to a quadratic form, you take this quadratic equation, and the solution of that is a point in the upper half plane. SL2Z acts on that in a standard way. And that will be our modular parameter. Here's an example I'll use throughout the talk to explain various ideas. Consider discriminant minus 20. These two forms have discriminant minus 20. They lead to these two values of tau. Both values of tau lie within the fundamental domain, and therefore they're SL2Z inequivalent, and therefore these two forms are inequivalent, showing you that the class number is bigger than 1. The distribution of these taus for large values of d is a very fascinating problem I've started to look at with a number theorist named Steve Miller. Well, back to black holes. Now, we know that the near horizon metric only depends on Z star, and we know that Z star is u-duality invariant, so that's good. U-duality equivalent charges lead to the same near horizon metric. What about the converse? How many u-duality inequivalent charges nevertheless lead to the same near horizon metric? You can answer that as follows. First, a charge P and Q is equivalent to a charge P prime and Q prime if and only if these binary quadratic forms that I introduced before are SL2Z invariant. That's S-duality. Secondly, the near horizon metric just depends on the determinant of Q, on the discriminant. So, therefore, if you reason upon these two statements a little, you conclude that the number of U-duality inequivalent charges is just the class number. And now a highly non-trivial result from number theory says that the class number grows, roughly speaking, like d to the 1/2. And that's, of course, the area. So the number of U-duality inequivalent backgrounds with the same near-horizon metric grows like the area. Now, for the second connection to arithmetic, one wants to look at the BPS mass spectrum. And the only model where we have enough control is the FHSV model. So let's consider electric and magnetic charges in this lattice now. It leads to a unique attractor point. And we ask, what is the BPS mass spectrum at the attractor point? I don't have time to explain the details, but the answer involves the arithmetic of a quadratic imaginary number field, K sub D sub PQ. So a quadratic imaginary number field, K sub D, is the rationals adjoined I square root of D, that is to say, complex numbers of this form. This is a generalization of Q. You can generalize integers, prime numbers, factorization, and all sorts of things like that. In this context, the masses turn out to be norms of ideals. And rather than explain that, let me show a picture. Here's our example. Oh, dear, it doesn't fit. Well, here's an example of the BPS masses at the two attractor points when discriminant is minus 20. You notice that, first of all, they're all integers. Secondly, they are disjoint. And third, not all integers appear. And the problem of finding out which integers do and don't appear is exactly the kind of problem that this kind of number theory is designed to answer. Now, for the third and most important connection to arithmetic, I have to use the theory of complex multiplication, which was a great preoccupation of the number theorists of the 19th century. And here's the gist. So our hero is the 2 by 2 binary quadratic form here. And as we've seen, we associate to it a quadratic imaginary modular parameter. Now, the J function has the amazing property that if you evaluate the J function on this quadratic imaginary number, then, in fact, you get an algebraic integer of degree the class number. In our favorite example here, there are 2 taus. The J function on these taus are these algebraic integers. The relevance to our problem is that the elliptic curve here has a Weierstrass presentation of this type, where this coefficient C of tau is expressed in terms of J of tau. J is an algebraic integer, so my Weierstrass model has an arithmetic elliptic curve. It's defined over K hat, where I adjoin the value of J of tau. Highly non-trivial fact, it doesn't depend on which of the inequivalent taus you put in. That's the main fact. A corollary of that main fact is that the n equals 4 and 8 attractors are arithmetic varieties defined over k-hat. Now, that k-hat is an important field extension in number theory. It's called the Hilbert class field. And an implication of class field theory is that the Galois group of q-bar over q permutes these u-duality inequivalent backgrounds. So, for example, here you see these two are related by taking changing the sign of the square root of 5, and that permutes the two backgrounds. Okay, that's the end of those three connections to arithmetic. There are some other connections. One connection to arithmetic is through F-theory. So we've seen that the attractor equations isolate certain K3 surfaces as being special. They are the exceptional K3 surfaces. They are elliptically fibered, and it's natural to ask what they mean in F-theory. Well, I remind you that F-theory in part is based on the identification of moduli spaces, the Neurane moduli space, with the complex structure moduli space. Here's the Grassmannian of space like two planes. And let's compare the attractor points for a pair of charges in this lattice. As we've seen, the F-theory side gives us exceptional K3 surfaces. What about the heterotic side? Well, Neurane moduli space is a space of projection operators of this real space onto its positive definite and negative definite parts. The attractor equations are just the equations that the left-moving projection of these two charges is zero. And though that is the equation that defines the rational conformal field theories, the result is that the heterotic rational conformal field theories are the F-theory duals of the attractor K3 surfaces. And using this dictionary, you can start to have fun with Mordell-Vey groups and things like that. I note that this realizes in part an old dream of, in small part, an old dream of Friedan and Schenker. You have a dense set of points in the Calabi-Yau moduli space, which can be understood, solved exactly by the rational conformal field theories. It also suggests a conjecture, which maybe this is more general, maybe type 2 on attractor varieties are somehow dual to rational conformal field theories in general. Well, another aspect of this story that you realize when thinking about the F-theory example is that the mirror map really has to have some interesting arithmetic properties. After all, what about the complex multiplication theory? Tau J of tau is a mirror map. And it takes these quadratic imaginary numbers to other algebraic numbers, very special field, the class field. What about the K3 mirror map? Well, here we map the heterotic moduli, the Kähler class, the complex structure, and the Wilson lines, to a elliptically fibered K3 surface. And we expect, given what I've said before, that quadratic imaginary periods should map to K3 is defined over, in general, some class field of K sub D. And I can't quite prove that, but I was able to check it for many families with some with codimension 1 in the moduli space. It all suggests the main conjecture of this talk, which is the arithmetic attractor conjecture, which says that if gamma is a charge that leads to an attractor point, then first of all, the special coordinates at the attractor point should be valued in a number field. And second of all, that point should parameterize an arithmetic Calabi-Yau defined over another number field. And the relationship between K and K hat should be that we should be something analogous to what we've seen from complex multiplication. So in particular, it should be a finite Galois extension of K. Now, general Calabi-Yau manifolds are very hard to deal with, and I haven't had a whole lot of success trying to verify that conjecture, but I had a minor piece of success thanks to the work of Candilis, Della Ossa, Font, Katz, and Morrison. They made a very detailed analysis of this two-parameter family of Calabi-Yau varieties, worked out the periods in particular, and mapped out the moduli space. I lifted this picture from a paper of Dave Morrison's. The blue lines are various devices where special things are happening. Here's the large complex structure limit. I was able to solve the attractor equations exactly along this divisor here, where there's Z8 monodromy. And the solution I can't go into, but let me say it confirms the arithmetic attractor conjecture perfectly. Now, a interesting spin-off of that calculation, not related to the main topic of this talk, but an interesting spin-off nevertheless, is that you can now find charges where you can solve the attractor equations exactly here and also, to good approximation, in the region of the large complex structure limit. So there are charges that lead to more than one solution of the attractor equations. Okay, now in terms of the dynamical system we had before, that means that there has to be basin of attraction phenomena. It means that when you start with specifying your moduli at infinity, you have to flow, you could flow to one solution or another, which is to say that n equals 2 black holes have extra hair, and I'll call it attractive hair, and a little calculation shows that the entropy indeed depends on the attractive hair. So how much time do I have? 5 minutes. Oh, okay, I didn't think I would be having time for this. Well, okay, so all of this fits into a very interesting tradition in number theory called Kronecker's Jugendtraum. And Kronecker was very fascinated by complex multiplication, and he was considering the problem of finding all abelian extensions of the number field Q. And the answer is known. That's the Kronecker-Weber theorem, and it goes like this. There is a magical transcendental function. It's called the exponential function. F of theta equals e to the 2 pi I theta. Well, if you think about it, de Moivre's theorem is not so trivial. The exponential function has the nice property that if you evaluate it on the torsion points of the circle, then you generate algebraic numbers. And these and the non-trivial fact is that these generate all the abelian extensions of Q. So Kronecker's Jugendtraum is the idea that this generalizes, that you can replace the rationals by the quadratic imaginary field. And when you do that, you replace the exponential function by the elliptic functions, J of tau. And if I had time to state it more precisely, I'd also have to introduce the Weierstrass functions. And let me stress that Kronecker's Jugendtraum is true. That's the theory of complex multiplication. But what about going beyond? Well, that's related to Hilbert's 12th problem. So in his famous address to the ICM in 1900, he encouraged mathematicians to generalize Kronecker's Jugendtraum, that is to find transcendental functions which take basically an arbitrary specified field into some nicely defined extension. And that has been in part answered by work of Shimura and Taniyama on abelian varieties of complex multiplication, but it's not completely solved. And the idea here is that maybe the physicists might have something to say about it. The hope is that maybe the transcendental functions given by the mirror map have the properties that Hilbert was seeking. So the generalization of the elliptic curve is replaced by a Calabi-Yau manifold. Point in the upper half plane is a point in Teichmuller space. Instead of a discriminant, we have a charge. The quadratic imaginary field is replaced by the attractor equation, and so on. Well, to conclude, it's clear that black holes, the compactifications with 16 and 32 supercharges, and in particular how they relate to black holes and black strings, have lots of interesting arithmetical questions associated with them. It would be really nice if these phenomena carry over to theories with 8 supercharges. There's a little bit of evidence, but not a whole lot. But if it works out, then this would possibly be the start of a new approach to some famous problems in mathematics. Thank you.
Any questions?
Yeah, so
the question is whether the relationship between the area of the black hole and the charges is for a fixed Calabi-Yau.
In this talk I've only mentioned K3 times T2. I think you're talking about this statement. I've only been talking about K3 times T2. It's true for other models. I just didn't have time. But this is within the context of K3 times T2, and the statement is that the number of u-duality inequivalent geometries, which nevertheless have the same near-horizon metric, grows like A when A is large.
Is there
another
statement for five-dimensional black holes?
Yes. In some cases, the FHSB case, my favorite is actually 60 BPS strings in F-theory. That's a kind of a fun example where you have deep, well, never mind. But it grows, in general, it grows like a power of the area of the horizon, I should say. The fact that the area is to the first power is a special property of K3 times T2.
More questions? Yes.
Yeah,
the question is, what happens on the line between the two basins of attraction?
That's a very nice question, and thanks for asking that. I actually don't know where the line lies in this example. It's a very complicated problem. These periods are incredibly complicated. But I know that there are basins of attraction. There might be more than two. I don't know. I just know that there's at least two. However, you can write down lots of systems where you can write down functions where the only minima, the only stationary points are local minima. No saddle points, no maxima. Okay? That's possible. And then you can look at what happens on the boundaries of the basins of attraction. And what typically happens is it runs off to infinity. So my guess for what happens in this case, although I don't know, my guess is that there's some fairly civilized line, civilized because you can write the attractor equations in terms of the gradient flow equations. So there's some fairly civilized line, and that if you're on that line, you'll go off to infinity. And you just can't make up your mind, so you have to go to infinity.
More questions? Let's thank Greg again.